Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Print Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Michael Morris. So let's, of course, talk about the signing of the Government of National Unity Statement of Intent between the DA and the ANC. And also the IFP and now the PA have also joined the Government of National Unity. So there was some really fascinating detail that's just come out recently about what happened in the negotiations. This was written by Helen Ziller, who is one of the DA's negotiators and also intimately involved in the whole process, as she's a senior leader of the DA. Just kind of laying out how closely cut the entire deal was to get some sort of statement of intent signed. So much so that on the day that they're going to vote for the speaker and president, they still didn't have a deal signed. In fact, while the night before they thought they were about to sort everything out with sort of 10 drafts of this deal, by 7:51, only a few hours before the election is supposed to take place, Ziller looks at the latest version the ANC has just sent her, and it's draft 14. The last one she had seen was draft 10. And a whole bunch of stuff had changed. Stuff that she felt made it so that the DA could not sign it. She sent it to John Steenhuisen and Tony Leon, who are also, of course, intimately involved in negotiations. And they said, we can't sign this. We were happy with version 10. We're not happy with version 14. Anyway, at some point during the discussion, during the sort of frantic running around and trying to sort out the last minute deal here, the draft numbers get scrapped, and then they send out, the ANC sends back a document titled final, and then another one called final, final, and then ultimately a third document called final, final, final. And Ziller talks in detail about how she wasn't able to properly read some of the thing because she was trying to, she forgot to take her laptop to Parliament. So she was trying to read the whole thing on her cell phone with a cracked screen. And she was furiously WhatsApping away to people. And basically, she says that it was almost entirely thanks to an accident being the way that the EFF handled things, that they actually had enough time to sign the deal. According to her, they were on the verge of not voting for an ANC speaker in Parliament until the EFF, as part of, I'm not entirely sure what it was, but I guess it's sort of parliamentary theatrics, or maybe they had a need to plan some sort of strategy quickly, called for a caucus break. And the Chief Justice, Raymond Zondo, after much arguing, relented, which allowed the DA and the ANC enough time to sign a final agreement. The DA said they would not have voted for the speaker if the agreement had not been signed, as then they would have no leverage. It's also got this great comment from Ziller's son, Thomas, who apparently told her, "Ma, you guys want to run the country, but you can't even manage version control," which is such a I found this whole column really gripping because it's a great little kind of piece of humanizing how chaotic politics often actually is behind the scenes, and how the sort of image politicians often like us to have of them, of these kind of suave manipulators moving about and, you know, plotting the destiny of countries, is not really the truth. In reality, people tend to spend their time kind of running around like headless chickens trying to put out fires, which I think is very much what this is. Michael, just on that, what do you make of all this?
I mean, I think your key thing there was, you know, bringing home the human element to what's going on here. And when I read that piece, I thought it was a great piece. And every now and then, Helen does write these pieces. And it reminds me that she was her first and foremost a journalist. Before she became a politician, she had that career in journalism. And I think it's something that really does instill in one an idea, a sense of the importance of the little things, the aggregate of many, many things that make the whole. And it's often complex. It's often one that requires trade-offs and pragmatism and so on, and through which, you know, one hopes to find a kind of principle driving the thing forward, whatever the thing is. And I think the great virtue of this piece is that it actually gives you a sense of being there on the one hand, and on the other, that these are human beings involved in this process. So I think you're absolutely right to highlight that. The little anecdote about her son, Thomas, I think his name is, reminds me of the many times that my own children have pick me out for stupidities or insufficiencies, but especially in the kind of technological field where one does in fact reveal one's sort of fumbling hopelessness. But so it's a delightful piece, but nevertheless also a very important one. And there are just a few things that really struck me as particularly significant. Buried in this piece, which is a very great account, but I highly recommend people to read it because it does take you right up to the actual process of doing politics of this kind. She makes this point. The first thing that I want to highlight is whatever its shortcomings, the alternative of aborting the deal at the 11th hour would have been psychologically devastating for all rational and reasonable South Africans. And I think that's a very important point for her to make there and for all of us to perhaps bear in mind. And the second one, which I thought was very interesting, and no doubt her intent here is also to send a signal to those who may be opposing her, certainly the ANC, and to many other people who are kind of mulling over what this all means. She writes here that President Cyril Ramaphosa sent in a team of ANC negotiators drawn from their brightest and best. They were tough and often unrelenting, but they wanted the best for South Africa, not themselves. So I think that tells us something quite interesting. Helen Zille is not the kind of person to indulge in politesse, to say things that she doesn't mean. She herself is, in the phrasing of her own piece here, tough and often unrelenting. I think I'm sure everybody who has ever had anything to do with her would agree with that. So for her to say this, I think we can take as an indication that she means that she's observed people that she's had to negotiate with, deal with in setting up this deal or helping to set up this deal, who really do want the best for South Africa and not for themselves. And I think that's quite a significant vote of confidence, I would say, in the process so far. As she has underscored in other two, we're into, you know, a completely new country, new territory here, new terrain. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be unpredictable. There are going to be enormous challenges. But if we do have a sense that people really do want to make an effort to produce a better administration that's going to actually serve national interests, then we're certainly on a better trajectory. I think that is what, indeed, as she says earlier, most rational and reasonable South Africans actually hope for. So yeah, all around very interesting, but behind it, of course, this serious and I think, you know, optimistic moment for the country.
So on that point, you know, as I've made clear on the show for a long time, up until now, that I was very skeptical of this kind of arrangement, but you know, I have an open mind on it, on whether it can actually work. And I thought there was another one of the sort of people involved in the DA negotiations, Ryan Kutsir, wrote a really interesting piece also in the media that just talks a little bit about how this coalition needs to go in order to work, at least from the DA's perspective. He said that the ANC during negotiations, it resisted to the very last the idea that electoral outcomes should determine cabinet positions. Indeed, it sought to unpick an agreement that government posts must be distributed in a manner broadly proportional to seats in parliament at the very moment MPs were filing into the House. It also resisted the idea that electoral outcomes should determine decision-making in government, but backed off when the DA made clear that there would be no agreement unless it did. And even now, it resists the idea that electoral outcomes should determine the government's policy agenda. This is quote someone in this piece saying that apparently at one point in the negotiations, the DA said to the ANC, you know, power sharing means we also get some power too, right? which I thought was a kind of an interesting comment. But there were some other things as well. He says that the ANC has cast this as a government of national unity and is bringing on board a lot more parties. There's talk of bringing on the Good Party, of bringing on the PAC as well into this negotiation. And they've already brought on board, of course, the IFP and the Patriotic Alliance, so that the ANC can avoid accusations which have already been leveled by both the ANC and the by the MK and the EFF, that the ANC has, quote, sold out to the whites. And there's been a very nasty sort of racialized attack on the new government of national unity to begin with. Kutsia goes on to say, indeed, if the ANC seeks in the coming week to palm the deal off with a few minor cabinet posts, the GNU might not last until Friday, leaving the president in charge of a minority government at the mercy of his opponents in parliament. The DA must in turn accept that that in holding the balance of power does not mean it should seek to dictate to the larger party. 22% of the vote is almost half of 40%, and the DA must embrace the electoral outcomes as much as the ANC. And in kind of drawing up solutions for how he thinks the government of national unity should work, he's got a couple: problem-solving, not paranoia; evidence-based policy-making; effective delivery, focusing on people regardless of their demographics, or political allegiance, who can get the job done; and leadership, which I think are all pretty sensible things. There's this great anecdote, which Michael, I'll leave to you to describe, that you mentioned in the pre-show discussion about when the ANC and DA sat down together at the negotiation table, some of the interesting things they thought about the other side.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Ryan's piece is very interesting, very like in taking us kind of into the process. He deals with it slightly differently, and as you say, he focuses a great deal of attention on the way forward and things to focus on, and so on. But there was this, as you say, this very interesting observation. He was saying that, you know, it became evident during the past week that both the DA and the ANC caricatures the other in ways that make progress difficult. So in the past, these caricatures may be assisted in sustaining the conflict, which was necessary, the electoral conflict. One had to try and beat the other, and not many things have changed. So, you know, it's now making progress difficult. And there was an interesting observation he made that we were astonished to discover the ANC is really concerned that we, the DA, might harbor a secret desire to withdraw the Western Cape from the Republic. And we were a bit offended by the suggestion we don't care about the plight of the poor. And then on the other hand, many in the ANC, by contrast, probably resent that the governing party is no more than a front for a criminal enterprise, and that the benefit, as Ryan could see arise here, the benefit of being in the same room, these fears and assumptions can be aired and dispelled. And I think that's a really crucial thing. It was never possible before now because of the balance of forces. The DA simply wasn't strong enough, and the ANC was too strong, you could say. Was strong enough to go it alone. And the point is reached now where, you know, one says that the moderate center is actually appearing almost automatically, but by virtue of an electoral outcome that does not give anyone the strength to dominate everyone else. And as a result of that, we're now pushed into an entirely different kind of politics, the kind of politics where we are sitting in the same room. We are discovering one another as ordinary human beings with, maybe stereotypical views of one another based on fears or anxieties and rhetoric that's been going for decades. And now suddenly you're encountering fellow South Africans who really do have some interesting ideas about how to run a government, how to run a country, how to grow jobs, to grow the economy, and so on. So it's all around a very interesting time. And potentially a very hopeful time too, I think.
So I think the next thing to watch out for is who gets which cabinet positions. That's also going to be an interesting indicator of how this thing is going to go, whether it's actually going to be a sort of government and national unity in name only, or whether there actually is going to be a genuine attempt at power sharing. Currently, there's this talk that the DA could get 7 cabinet positions. It's not clear how many there will be in total, but there's also been some talk about reducing cabinet to sort of 26 positions. I think it's closer to 30 currently. There's also some talk of giving the IFP traditional affairs and separating that out from local government, where it currently is bundled. And the ANC is been some ANC sources have been telling the media anonymously that they want to give the DA water and sanitation, energy, local government, and trade and industry. I have a lot to say about that, but not on today's episode because we are running close on time. Mm. But there has been, I think, the announcement of the MECs in KZN when we have a much more complicated coalition between the IFP as the biggest party, the ANC as the second biggest party, the DA third, and then the NFP last place. I think the DA got the finance position in KZN, which I'm sure they'll be fairly happy about. Or maybe not. After all, being the treasurer is never a position that makes you very popular. No. Michael, any final thoughts? Close it for today.
Yeah, I mean, just maybe to highlight something that Ryan wrote about, where he says that the good news is that power sharing arrangements are often surprisingly stable. And, you know, a lot of our anxiety is that these things can't possibly work because we're dealing with irreconcilable forces. But he makes the point that while it's true that a party with the balance of power can bring down the government, when your ultimate leverage is termination, you find yourself reticent to use it, not least because if you do, you can only do so once. I think that's quite a telling insight into the kind of things we're dealing with now, is that those who can perhaps feel that they have an enormous power to wield would be reluctant to do so in the final instance simply because it would bring the entire thing down. Very interesting and all quite exciting.
Indeed. So we will keep watching it very closely to see how this thing develops and offering our commentary and analysis of things as they go on. Anyway, we hope that you found the show interesting. We will see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.